I can't hear you. Oh, as soon as you got started, I lost you.
Jesus Christ. All right. I'm going to try not to kick that over again. All right. Let's do it this time. What's up, UX fam? How's your mom and them? Welcome to another episode of Beyond UX Design. I'm Jeremy. If you're new here, welcome to the show. I am super stoked to have you. Before we jump into the normal stuff today, I want to give a shout out to Miguel for leaving some awesome feedback for the Beyond UX Design book, Master Your Craft Beyond Pixels and Prototypes. Don't forget, if you get the book from beyonduxdesign.com/book, you can use the code LISTENER to get 10% off your copy. Then leave some honest feedback. You'll get a chance to win a shout on the show just like this. So head on over to beyonduxdesign.com/book. Use the code LISTENER to get 10% off your copy today. This week's episode is brought to you by Jeff White and his UX Storytelling Toolkit. Now, lots of people talk about the importance of storytelling for UX designers, but Jeff brings actionable clarity to the concept and he shows you exactly how to do it. He breaks down different real-world scenarios like how to use different storytelling methods to present your work to clients and stakeholders, how to craft a better case study for your portfolio, and how to improve portfolio presentations for job interviews. And I love Jeff's approach to storytelling here. It's not your simple once-upon-a-time kind of stuff. And since you're an amazing listener, and I know that this course will help you out so much, I've partnered with Jeff to get everybody listening a 10% discount if you use the code BEYONDUX when you check out. So head on over to beyonduxdesign.com/storytelling and use the code BEYONDUX to check out to get 10% off Jeff's storytelling course. So learn some incredible techniques to influence your team and advance your UX career. And if you haven't done it already, please consider subscribing to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you are a regular here and you feel like you're getting something out of the show, I would really appreciate you leaving a 5-star review. That'll help me out so much more than you can imagine. And as always, thanks so much to Chris, Siriquan, Stacy, Radu, Megan, Andrew, John, Mark, and Kevin for all their support. And if you want to join these fine folks and many others and help keep the show independent and ad-free, you'll get access to rough transcripts and exclusive access to the entire video library of episodes, including access to episodes before they're released. You can get all that for as little as $3 a month. That's less than a dollar an episode. For more information on how you can support the show and help more people find out about what we're doing here, make sure to check out beyonduxdesign.com/support. And of course, if you think the show is worth sharing, then I would love it if you told some friends. So if you've been on the internet for the last 6 months or more, if you've been on LinkedIn or Twitter or wherever, you have probably seen what I think I'm going to start calling the great PM UX schism, the PM UX debate, where it's just PM versus UX and everybody's blaming everybody else for processes and stealing their jobs and everything else. So I've got my buddy Tom Drugan on today. He's a product manager. He works in a sea of UXers. He may not be the archetypal product manager bad guy that you hear about all over the internet, but you know, he is a product manager. So we're going to talk about all of this today, and I'm really excited to kind of get into it. Not get into it with Tom. We're not going to fight or anything, but get his perspective on this whole idea of the UX versus PM debate. So I'm really excited about that. With a career spanning over 2 decades in technology, Tom has focused on project and product management. His advocacy for user-centered design was sparked by the challenges that he faced as an entrepreneur and was further reinforced at a startup that emphasized user testing. And this experience led to a long-standing partnership with Slide UX, culminating in his role as partner in 2022. And at Slide UX, Tom is the sole product manager working among a sea of UX designers, emphasizing the integration of product management and user experience to enhance product outcomes. So Tom, welcome to the show. I am super stoked to have you.
Jeremy, super stoked to be here. I've been excited about this conversation since we first spoke. And very, very timely topic. So I'm excited to get into it.
We had some technical difficulties here in the beginning of the show. I wasn't sure if we'd have to postpone. So I'm excited, man. I'm really excited to have a product manager's perspective and get your thoughts on all this. So before we get into that, I read your bio a little bit, but I think you've got an interesting backstory of how you ended up, you know, being embedded with this, as a partner with all these UX designers at a UX agency. So tell us a little bit about your journey and how'd you end up where you are today?
So yeah, I've been doing this kind of product thing since the late 90s. So I started off at an agency in a project management role. My claim to fame back then was I built the first Kraft macaroni and cheese website and Lunchables website. Oh, wow. for a big client at Kraft.
That's awesome.
Sort of carried that through marketing. And then I got into more traditional product role really as an entrepreneur. So I struck out on my own with a couple partners that I had previously worked with. And we built a social network back in 2005 that tried to compete with the likes of LinkedIn and Facebook. And inevitably, we lost. But that carried me into a product career over the next 15 or so years at multiple startups, one that IPO'd, another one that got bought by a private equity firm. Back in one of the startups that I worked with, we were growing so fast, we couldn't hire UX talent back fast enough. And this is back in 2012. And so we ended up bringing in an outside firm called Slide UX and got to work really closely with the founding team and their team as they built it out. And they were really my UX team for across three different companies over the next 6 or 7 years. And built such a intrinsically attached relationship that I couldn't imagine my life without them. So yeah, they gave me an opportunity to join them back in 2019, and I eventually became partner in 2022. So yeah, I have this kind of unique background where I fully embedded product manager, built out large product orgs, and kind of jumped the chasm and ended up joining a UX firm. And really for me, it was, you know, not only did I love working with this team, but I really wanted to get closer to user-centered design, which, you know, unfortunately, a lot of product managers don't get the opportunity to do because, you know, execs and cultures aren't really, you know, looking to invest in proper user research and user-centered design.
What was that social media app that you were working on? What was it?
It's called Names.
Okay. I haven't.
Terrible branding idea that I came up with, NAYMZ.com.
Okay.
And we were kind of in the conversation for a bit back in 2006, 2007. Couldn't compete with the coffers that the LinkedIn of the world's had.
That was before Microsoft got them too. So, but that was still, Name, was it more like a professional network type of thing?
Yeah, it started off as a way to promote your personal brand on search engines. So it was a bit of a paid search and SEO play, but for your own name. And then it sort of bled out to, you know, we had a lot of professionals signing up. So we sort of tried to ride the wave that the LinkedIn was riding back then.
Well, that's cool. Well, it didn't work out, but it seems like you learned quite a bit, and obviously you're doing some good stuff right now. So I'm curious, this whole debate, the PM versus UX debate, the great schism. I like to call it the schism because I feel like we've just sort of grown apart over the last few years and culminating, yeah. I feel like with, I don't know if you remember this, but with Figma Config last year, Airbnb announced that, you know, they were removing their product management function, and the crowd erupted in cheer and applause, which I just find to be such a sad event.
Ugh.
So I'm curious, from your perspective as a product guy, what do you feel? How do you feel about this whole debate, this antagonism, I guess is a better word, between these two, you know, monolithic groups of UX versus PM?
Yeah, it's so disheartening because, you know, I certainly, from a product perspective, I have valued UX has been so important to my career and my success in product, and vice versa. So as a partner at a UX firm, we're so much more successful when there is a good product partnership on the other side of the fence, which is really why I was initially brought in, to kind of help bridge the gap for some clients who may not be mature on the product side of things. But, you know, looking back, it's been a rough year and a half, right? I mean, we had this kind of amazing 2022 where jobs were aplenty, salaries were really out of control, things were just humming along. And then, at least for us, kind of November of 2022 just kind of hit a brick wall. You know, capital is hard to come by. There's less investments in new products. Executives are tightening their belts, which obviously has led to lots of layoffs and that have been in the news across, you know, not only just product, but UX and engineering and other tech jobs. And, you know, for me, it's kind of human nature, right? Like, it's a bit of a survival instincts. You know, we're all sort of backed into a corner. A lot of us are fighting for jobs. And the more we own, the more indispensable we can become to our employers. And so there's always been this kind of inherently fuzzy overlap between what product and UX does, which in good times is a really good thing, right? Because I can jump in and tweak some Figma files or put together some initial wireframes if my partner on the UX side is too busy. And vice versa, you know, they can jump in and, you know, add some tickets to a backlog or sit in a grooming session. And so it's always been a good partnership, but all of a sudden we're kind of bumping heads and fighting for territory. And it's been rough. You know, you and I have talked about this, just some of the conversations happening on LinkedIn and other forums, like it's really tough to see. And, you know, you brought up the Airbnb thing. I think certainly that kind of caused ripples through the product space where our jobs are all of a sudden being shifted over to product marketers within that org. And, you know, for me, it kind of feels like a Braveheart moment where there's kind of a call to arms for each of these facets. And, you know, they're trying to claim their respective, you know, claim their territories and be the ones to come out on top. And, you know, that's just, it's really caused a lot of tension between our roles and with it, you know, not only within organizations, but then it bleeds out publicly to social media and other forums.
Yeah, I feel you on that. Because for me, you know, this is my philosophy. I need to get this put on like mugs and t-shirts. But I feel like you cannot build great software without great relationships. And you can't. I mean, there's just, you know, software is already hard enough. The code is hard enough. The technical piece is hard enough. You know, software is even infinitely harder when you can't work well with the people that you deal with every day, you know, and you end up just being 100%. Able to, you make it impossible to ship anything if you do not have great relationships. And the other thing that I also see a lot too, is sort of finger pointing. It's your fault that this is happening. You're the person who does this. And, you know, I don't want to like name names, but there was a big author. I'll say she's famous. She posted a thing about like, you know, UX designers, she's hearing from UX designers that she is the reason, her book is the reason why they're losing their jobs. So she opened up the comments and said, tell me about it. And all these people kind of like started piling on her, you know, for better or worse. And then obviously the product people are there like defending her. And it just like, it ended, that comment thread ended up being like a complete shit show.
Yeah.
Anyway, but there's that finger pointing too. And I'm curious, like from your perspective, like how do you feel about, you know, one author or another being blamed for this or that? Do you feel like anybody should be taking blame, or is it a system? Is it a systemic issue? Is it something else? Do you have any thoughts? I mean, you mentioned the economy and budgets and things like that. Is it that simple, or is there something else to it?
I think there's a confluence of things happening. And in terms of, you know, these authors or influencers in the product space, and it goes beyond product. I mean, there's a healthy amount of ego in product, in UX. I've certainly worked with UXers who I can't relate well to, or, you know, that is you know, not a good partner and kind of wants to do things their way. And, and certainly there's plenty of us in the product space. And, you know, you see a lot of these influencers in the product space who, unfortunately, you know, and I don't know what their backgrounds are. I don't know how they came to this conclusion, but sort of view UX as a product of function and sort of there to support us versus a true partnership. And you know, and I think in good times when there's plenty of UX jobs out there and there's plenty of money being invested in it, then people aren't so sensitive on the UX side about it. But now that, you know, things are constricting and we're all under a bit of pressure, I think it's, you know, you're getting a lot more pushback, and rightfully so, right? So, you know, I can't speak for, you know, I'm aware of the thread you talked about. I came across it. I can't speak for them, but, you know, I think it's a bit of a sign of the times. And, you know, outside of just the kind of organizational pressures where there's a bit of generalization happening, and a lot of it's not just, you know, part of it's being forced down from executives and decision makers within organization, right? Because you have like Susie who does product and Jim, her counterparty, does UX design, and execs see that Susie as a product manager can also do user research and put together wireframes and maybe knows her way around Figma. And so you're seeing a lot of organizations that are pushing out people and sort of consolidating our two roles because it, you know, it's less overhead, it's less expenses. And so, you know, I think there's some, you know, there's some understanding from my perspective is why people are pointing fingers. You know, and then the whole other aspect that, you know, I think is also a player is just AI, right? I think we're all freaking out a bit. It has sort of hit this whole evolution of ChatGPT and AI being in the zeitgeist all of a sudden put us into, you know, it sort of rocked my world. I was, you know, playing with these tools and I'm like, oh, this is cool. There's so many possibilities here. And then the realization hit, it's like, oh crap, this could take my job. And so I think this, you know, this kind of idea of AI hanging out there that within 3 to 5 years, it could really disrupt what we do and who we are is also adding some additional pressures to where we're at.
I definitely want to talk about the AI stuff. I want to get into that. But before we move on to the AI stuff, I think it's worth talking about some of the theories and some of these books and some of these authors have been putting out there. And I'm curious, I want to get your thoughts on some of these. I'm going to throw some stuff out there. And from a product perspective, I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'll tell you what I think, and then I'm curious, I want to hear your thoughts on it. But a couple of things that I'm kind of, I get frustrated with, and again, I don't want to blame authors, I'm not pointing fingers necessarily, but it does frustrate with me. And I'm going to tell this story via a little anecdote. But my wife and I were driving, we were driving home from, we were originally from New Orleans, we were driving from Kentucky down to New Orleans, and when we drive on long road trips, my wife is a product manager, and she likes to listen to podcasts and stuff. So we were listening to Melissa Perry's podcast, and she was interviewing the guy who wrote the book about product-led growth. And we're talking about product-led growth, and they're you know, all this stuff, and they're talking about how the product should be easy to use, and it should deliver value to the users, and instead of having a marketing team or a sales team hound you with emails and all this, like, I should be able to just create an account, try it out for free, and decide to pay for it versus setting up a demo and having someone walk me through it and constantly hounding me and all this stuff. And I'm just thinking, I'm like, yeah, that's great. But like, you keep saying product-led growth. What you're actually saying is like outcome or value-led, or like I'm getting something out of this and that is causing me to want to pay. It's not the product itself. Like I'm able to do something. And if I'm able to do something, that product is valuable to me and I will then subscribe and pay or sign up or whatever it is I want to do, right? And it just like blows my mind, like listening to them, because they just keep saying product. And my wife is like, well, what's wrong with that? And I'm like, because when you say product led, the first thing everybody's going to jump to is product management led. And even in the conversation, they kept qualifying this. So like, we're not talking about product management led. We're talking about the product itself. And I'm like, if you have to qualify it and say product led, not product management led, it's product, the product led.
Yeah.
Something's wrong there. Like the language that you're using is broken. If you have to qualify, why say product led? And so when I hear that, and then I see other people saying like product first, the same kind of thing. It's like, sometimes the product is not the answer. Sometimes the service is the answer. Sometimes it's a paper process. Sometimes it's a physical process. Sometimes it is a phone call, you know, sometimes it's an email or something, whatever it is. Like the product isn't always the answer, you know? And I think that like, that drives me crazy, because when I hear that, I feel like this is sort of what I get. And this is what I want to hear your thoughts on. I've worked in enterprise for a long time, right? And I feel like those methods, those theories, they work really well. If I am a small team creating a really quick app and I'm selling that thing and that product is the thing I'm selling. But when you start having larger orgs, bigger companies, corporations, I think a Kroger or a Walmart, right? Like you can't think product first anymore, because you have to think about the service and the overall customer experience from end to end. And when I hear people pushing that, it's pushed as if like that's the answer to everything, but it's like the context, just like everything else, matters. And it's not product in that case, it's service, and it's service led, and it's value, and it's customer led. So anyway, I'm just curious, from your perspective, when you hear that kind of stuff as a product manager, what goes through your head? And do you think I'm totally full of crap? Which is totally fine if you think that, but I'm curious what a product manager thinks about that. And, you know, do you rebut that, or do you have a counterpoint, or do you agree? I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, I think there's always been a bit of a misbranding or mislabeling, not only in regards to product led growth, but just overall titles, right? This idea of product manager or product owner, or we're often referred to as the CEO of our product, right? Which will lend who's ever in that role tend to believe that they have the ultimate sort of authority to make decisions, and that can cause a bunch of strife within a true agile or product team. So I think there's probably an opportunity to sort of reassess the owner or manager title role. But let's talk about product-led growth specifically. So we certainly have helped several companies over the years sort of shift from the traditional sales-led organizations to product-led growth. From a organizational standpoint, it's really attractive, right? Instead of staffing up a team of expensive salespeople and going through a really arduous, long sales process that requires a lot of handholding, why not just have the product sell itself? And maybe, like you said, product may not be the right term, it's technology. But I think if you were to rebrand it as sales, or, I like you use the word value. I think that would work really well. But service, I think that would kind of confuse some folks, because they're trying to get away from the manual servicing of the actual technology and getting it to be more self-service, right? Where the answers are there for you, either through, documentation or AI, or like a really well-designed onboarding experience, things of that nature. So I'm with you. I think product-led growth, whether it was intentional or not to brand it that, whenever somebody came up with that, I don't know if it was Melissa or not, but came up with that term, I can see why it could cause confusion and also, be a bit misleading from, how that is supported within our organization.
Yeah, I think like outcome is maybe a better way to say that, like outcome led, because like there's an outcome there. Like, what is the outcome? At the end of the day,
I like that.
The outcome, there's an outcome for the business. There's an outcome for the customer, So what is the outcome that we're trying to go for? And I think that should, it's funny because you always hear about like feature factories and they just build a bunch of crap to build a bunch of crap. And if you start thinking about, to me, product led, that to me is like, it almost becomes like a driver for feature factory, because you're just like, well, what can we put in the product to make people buy? Product, like feature. When in reality, people just want an outcome to be met, you know, whatever that is, whether that's to just hang out with their friends or to buy a thing or to complete a task or solve some problem for them, you know? And I don't know. Anyway, that was the other thing too, that when I was talking to my wife, I was just like, what's stopping anyone just loading in feature, you know? I don't know. Anyway, go ahead. You want to say something?
I hear you. Let me circle back for a second, because I'm a fractional head of product for a AI tech company. It's one of my clients, and they had a traditional sort of sales/support operation for 10 years in the insurance space. And so they had to staff up a bunch of customer support people and salespeople and all that. And they made the determination a few years ago that they wanted to kind of ride this product-led growth philosophy. And they laid off all those people. And we're in the process of building technology where, you know, there's going to be AI that basically does what their advisors and their customer support did. And so from that, you know, I think the term product-led, it sort of pinpoints that they are trying to not use human capital and use technology. Mm. And I think that's really the underlying thing that the product-led growth, you know, advocates of it are trying to convey versus, you know, just being a feature factory. So they're trying to get rid of all the stuff you just mentioned of the phone calls and the, you know, the email customer support and so forth.
Well, you know, I mean, that's the thing though. And that's where I go back with this is like, you can't swing, I don't think, too far either end of the pendulum. Because at some point, humans want to talk to a human, right? Like, they don't want to talk to a human every step of the way. But when they need a human, and that human's not there,
duh,
you're going to have a very bad experience, you know? And so, it's one of those things, like, you can't go too far. You have to find, like, the medium somewhere in the middle. But anyway, I don't know. That's frustrating, because I feel like, especially with when it comes to, like, AI, it's such a new thing. You're going to have a lot of customers, I feel like, and I'm not trying to critique your client or anything, but like, you're going to have a lot of customers that are probably going to get stuck. They're probably going to have problems or trouble. And when someone says, I don't know, go read the documentation, you know, someone's going to be like, I don't want to read the documentation. I want someone to help me, you know?
Totally. I just dealt with this last week. I had a check that I sent out for, it's Chase Banks, a check that I had them send out, and the check never got delivered to the recipient. And so I just had this money kind of pulled out of my account sitting there, and I didn't no idea where that check was. And it took me forever to, you know, pick up the phone and actually get somebody on the call to help me address it. And I couldn't do it through my account. So I'm totally with you. I think there's organizations that are swinging way too far to cutting the human out of the equation.
Yeah. And I think that to me goes back to this idea of like the product itself is not the answer there, right? It's like that outcome is the answer. The outcome is, you know, with big companies like Chase or Bank of America, whatever, there's a million outcomes. But, you know, when you think about that, it's like the product is not always the answer. Like sometimes I want to go into a bank and then talk to a teller, you know, and that experience is completely outside the software team. It's completely outside the control of a UX designer, outside of a product manager. But that there has to be, you know, we're getting, I think, a little bit more into like customer experience overall, like service design. But, you know, when those small companies, you know, like a startup, they don't have to deal with that. But like, I think that's where this drives me kind of crazy with product-led growth and product first and all that stuff. It's like, they're speaking to a very specific audience, but the messaging is more like it's for everybody. But like in reality, their suggestions and their advice, to me at least, should be geared towards a very specific group, but they're trying to market it as the answer to all software woes. You know what I mean? So
anyway,
totally I think that's what like drives me crazy more about product first and product led growth and move fast and break stuff. You know, like that works in certain environments. It works when you're a Silicon Valley tech startup, but when you start like building like healthcare tools or, you know, you're like a big industrial conglomerate, you can't move fast and break stuff. You know, United Healthcare can't move fast and break stuff, you know. The VA can't move fast and break stuff. I don't know. That to me just sort of drives me nuts. All right. So we talked about that. Oh, go ahead.
Yep. And, you know, this goes back to sort of the human-centered philosophy is that, you know, there's a lot of companies trying to take the human out of the equation. And I can understand why that's frustrating. And it is for me too, in certain situations. But yeah, I think there'll be a reckoning, I think, at some point.
All right. So that's my beef with product-led, product first and all that stuff. I think it's more a semantics thing than anything else. But because I think like for me, I will say this. The concepts behind product-led growth to me are sound. Like, I don't want to have a sales team. I don't want to have a demo. I don't want to have people hounding me. When am I going to create an account? I want to create an account, play around with it. And if I decide, I like that. Just want to clarify before we move on. I love the idea of that. It's just like, to me, the the messaging around it is where it kind of falls. All right. So I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of, like, you know, we'll talk about like the current landscape a little bit. And we talked a little bit about these generalists. We talked a little bit about AI's rise. From your perspective, you mentioned this before, a lot of overlap. You think of like a Venn diagram. There's tons of overlap in the middle between what a UX designer and a product manager can actually do. And now, you know, where the scarcity causes conflict. And so we're starting to kind of butt heads. AI is making it even worse because it's taking away parts of our job. We're like, what are we going to do? So talk to me a little bit more about like this current landscape. I know I kind of stopped you a little bit from talking about AI and all that stuff, but AI is very new still. And I think it's very ambiguous. We don't know where this is going to go. I think that's part of the problem too.
Nope.
So talk a little bit about that from your perspective, as far as like PM and UX goes, and where you see kind of things right now.
So right now, you know, as I mentioned, last year was rough. We're seeing trends here and other folks we talk to in our space in terms of UX consulting. Things are starting to get better, I think, from an economic standpoint. So more clients are coming our way and, you know, more opportunities with existing clients and so forth. So I think some of the economic stressors that go along with layoffs and so forth are subsiding. I think we're going to get back to normal at some point this year, or feeling a bit more normal. So that's good. That's kind of the current landscape. But what I'm concerned about is sort of underneath that current is these AI tools are evolving at a rapid pace that can't really replace much of what we do today, but it's coming. And so we're trying to think through strategically, like where do we move? What do we do to, you know, to either counteract this or to get in front of this? And so we're talking a lot about AI and so where the industry is going. You know, I think there's really two opposing viewpoints of this that I've seen out on social and just listening to podcasts and so forth. And you have kind of the optimist view, right? So the Jacob Nielsens of the world who are really putting a positive spin on where AI is taking us. And I'll say my partners here who are UX designers or practitioners, they sort of subscribe to the optimist view as well. And really the thought is that, hey, AI is going to make creating products way faster, way easier. And so there's just going to be a heck of a lot more products out there on the market. And since a lot of these products are being created by machines or non-UX practitioners, they're going to be garbage or flawed or, you know, not user-centered, as we talked about. And so there's going to be a lot more job opportunities for folks in the UX space to come in and clean things up. And thus, there'll be more jobs for UX practitioners, not less. And, you know, I think the optimists are sort of looking at this as like, hey, if we stay on top of AI trends and tools and figure out how to leverage them, then, you know, we can stay the course and UX won't be radically transformed. And so, you know, there's that side of the coin that, you know, when I wake up on a good day that I fully believe in. But then, you know, I've watched a lot of sci-fi movies and read enough influencers out there that have the opposite take, right? This more dystopian view where there could be major societal shifts that happen. And so, you know, when I'm on the product side of things, I am leveraging generative AI on a daily basis, right? It is creating really good user stories and requirements and acceptance criteria that probably go beyond what I would have done if I just did it, you know, by hand. And certainly, you know, we've done a fairly thorough audit of the tools available for UX out there today in terms of AI, and it's just not ready, right? They're not there yet. But, you know, futurists that are way smarter than me are saying, you know, within 5 to 10 years, like AI is going to be doing a lot of what we do as well, if not better, and certainly much faster. And, you know, I don't know if you saw this, this just came out a few days ago, but the CEO of NVIDIA was at a world government summit or something in Dubai and basically said that, like, hey, students, stop learning how to code. You're wasting your time AI is going to be doing code for us in this near distant future. And so there's this like healthy fear of, well, shoot, if it's going to take over engineering, it's certainly going to take over design and product. And so, you know, two shifting views. Let me just recap by saying, I think I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm pragmatic by nature. So I don't think the product management and UX design and engineering is going to completely go away, at least not in our lifetimes. And hopefully not before I retire. But, you know, it's been pointed out many times, somebody's going to need to be there to build these tools, these AI tools, and design these tools. And I'm cautiously optimistic that sort of the offset in automation is going to be, there will be an offset based on just the, like I said, the amount of new products out there for us to support.
So I feel like I'm with you on this whole idea of like it could go either way. And I feel like here's one thing that I kind of think about is like, I have a feeling that you're very right. In 5-10 years from now, a machine will be able to spit out an interface like nobody's business, right? But then I also think about how generative AI has basically decreased the need for an interface. You know, it's really at this point, like a bank app, a chat app with a bank, you could say, show me my accounts, show me my thing, move money. How much money do I have? Transfer from one account to the next. There is no interface anymore. There's a chat interface, obviously, but you know, one chat interface is the same as every other chat interface. It doesn't need to be any, you don't have to worry about pixel spacing and, you know, like buttons design and all these things. And these complex interactions become as simple as like, you know, or as complex as the request. So you don't really need the interface anymore. Assuming you do need interfaces, chat, you know, these AIs will probably spit that out. But the thing that I keep going back to is, you know, how much will a AI or a machine be able to understand the problem in the first place to give it requirements? Because the generative AI still requires someone to give it the input. And you have to know what the right input is, otherwise you get garbage out, right? So that's where I think about, you know, until, you know, we've got data like from Star Trek running around actually talking to humans, you know, you're going to have a very hard time getting discovery. You know, that's something that a chat GPT or AI won't be able to do probably very well. Research, especially ethnography, you know, watching people work in an industrial setting or enterprise setting, you know, observation, that kind of stuff, you're going to have a very hard time. I mean, maybe you could have, you know, surveys automatically go out and responses automatically gathered, but surveys are notoriously bad at collecting, you know, accurate data. They can be biased. So if there's bias built in the system, it's going to be built into the survey and you're going to end up getting junk back. So, you know, I feel like to me, a human is still going to be on that research end. And the UI piece is probably going to go away, and not maybe not altogether, but I think it will at some point. So I feel like there's still going to be a need for that. The other thing that I think about, and I was talking with Jason and Effie from the UXperts podcast not long ago, and they brought up, I guess it was a podcast episode from Freakonomics about when the record player was introduced, and it completely upended the piano market. Piano companies that had been in business for hundreds of years shut down. The hundreds or thousands of people that were building pianos were laid off and needed to find work. And there's that whole supply chain that goes along with it. So all the companies that were producing parts for pianos went out of business. The piano maintenance companies, the tuning companies, they all went out of business because now you could just buy a record player and play whatever song you wanted, right? But when you think about it, it opened up an entirely different industry. The recording industry became bigger, right? You ended up with that whole supply chain for recording industry and the recording studios and all those things. And then the sales and the shops to sell the records and all those things, you know? And so you ended up with a completely different market. And so the thing that I kind of think about with AI, and it's not exactly the same, obviously, but I feel like there's going to be an opportunity to find work somewhere else in a different space that may not be the exact same job, but might be similar to your job. But then the other interesting thing, if you think about this, is like the people who could play a piano really well, they started to make a lot more money because you could hire them to play. You know, it was a specialized skill. Whereas before, everybody and their grandpa could play piano, probably not very well, but everybody could play a piano, you know? So, you know, that, but then like the people who would tune a piano, the people who could fix your piano, they ended up, you know, most of them ended up leaving the industry, but the few who stuck around, we got really good. And now, you know, instead of spending $10 to come tune a piano, now they're charging thousands of dollars to tune a piano. So, you know, I feel like there's still going to be, even in the future, because that's, let's face it, generative AI is only built off of what's already been done. Maybe in the future, it'll be good at creating new and novel ideas, but generally it's only good at mixing and matching what's already been produced. So there's still going to be a need for someone to create new ideas. You know, and until like they figure that problem out where generative AI is just being built on more generative AI crap, you know, there's like a downward death spiral. I'm curious what your thoughts are there. I mean, this is, I don't know, I think goes for both product management and UX, but I feel like there's an opportunity in the future. It's just, you have to know how to pivot and get there, maybe early versus being like the ones who just sort of like left behind. I don't know.
Yeah. I love the piano and music industry anecdote. I've heard something similar. I read an article a while back, similar to like when Excel came out in the early 80s, all of a sudden put all these kind of bookkeepers and accountants out of work. But so there was sort of a dip in the, you know, that role over the years, but then other roles emerged out of it and actually hired more people. So I hope that's the case. I agree that, you know, I think it's really going to transform what we do and how we do it. And other, you know, other industries are going to emerge out of it. So yeah, definitely in line with that. and I brought this up before to folks internally over here, I do think that there's always going to be a space for kind of bespoke UX design, because I do think as products get churned out of AI, they're probably going to have a lot of similarities, right? We're all going to be using the same best practices that that these machines have been trained on. And you're going to get a lot of, you know, the same looking interfaces, which is going to get bland and boring. And so, you know, I've used the example of like furniture makers, right? There's still folks that make handmade furniture. And if you have the money and the desire to pay somebody to build a custom chair or table, that's awesome, right? Because it's going to look different and it's going to be crafted to your particular taste versus something that gets turned out of an IKEA manufacturer. So I'm with you. I still think there's going to be a path forward for folks that really embrace the craft side of what we do. There may be a bit of a shakeout or sort of a time period where they aren't that in demand, but I do, you know, fast forward, let's say 20, 50 years, I still think that there's going to be a demand for those folks.
It's going to be hard, obviously, especially in the transition phase. It's a lot later on when that becomes like a specialized skill. I think one of the big problems with UX design, and I'm not sure what the product management field looks like, but like over the pandemic, you know, everybody was hiring like crazy. You could get a job in a matter of weeks. You could hop around and get job to job to job. Now, you know, there are thousands of people applying to one job, you know, one role, 1,000 people. And so people just cannot find work. And I think eventually that'll settle. The dust will settle there, you know, and you'll either, you know, think of it in terms of supply and demand, the equilibrium is out of whack. So like at some point, supply and demand curve will get back to equilibrium in theory, you know, if you believe the Keynesian economics camp. But, you know, you'll have, in theory, less people will want UX jobs. There, maybe the more UX jobs will open and eventually you'll end up with like somewhere in the middle. But, you know, that whole thing, like you said, it takes time and like there's a shakeup and at some point the dust settles and maybe 5-10 years from now, things start to even out until some new revolutionary technology comes along and, you know, totally. Who knows? But I want to talk a little bit about this idea of like the turf war. And you mentioned before, you know, there's a Venn diagram, a lot of overlap, who does what, who owns what. You mentioned this and you called it out earlier. I think it's worth calling out is that, you know, product manager assumes like we're managing things. And I want to talk a little bit about like this idea from your perspective, as the dust starts to settle, who owns what? And you even had this interesting idea of like, do the two roles converge into one? And UX designers, it's a PM UX hybrid over the time. Talk to me a little bit about that idea of who does what from your perspective. I'm really curious to hear.
I do think things are going to kind of stabilize and go back to the way they've been for, let's say, the last 10 to 20 years for a period of time. You know, in terms of who does what, I've worked for, you know, small startups versus I've also worked at, you know, kind of large enterprise companies. And a lot of it just depends on the organization, right? You know, product folks at startups have to wear lots of hats. They're, you know, sometimes they're doing, you know, user research, you know, competitive research, UI design. But, you know, larger enterprise organizations where, you know, you come from, there's a lot of specialized roles. On the product side, you have like a product manager, a product owner, scrum master, sometimes product analyst. So I just want to preface all this. I think it's going to differ depending on the type of organization that you're employed by. But looking forward, and you touched on this, you know, as I'm spending my days interacting with generative AI and ChatGPT, I'm sort of formulating this concept that, you know, within short order, I'm going to be able to do through AI what I'm currently handing off to designers, engineers, certainly content creators. And so I see potentially our roles sort of converging. And, you know, larger organizations may be different where they got the coffers and the money to continue to hire specialists. But I see if I'm a smaller or mid-sized business owner, and I can find somebody who can sort of traverse both product design and potentially engineering by leveraging technology, I'm going to go that route, right? It's going to save me a lot of money and potentially a lot of time. So I'm sort of, and you touched on this, I see this need for the conduit between humans and machine, right? So that person who can run workshops with stakeholders and users and run, you know, generative research projects and do go out and sort of assess different competitors out there. I still think that's going to be needed. But like you said, I think somebody's going to be able to need to translate that into prompts or whatever it may be that the AI is going to be able to produce artifacts from. And then, you know, and then our job on the other side is going to have to be to basically QA or quality control that, right? Because as you see now, I mean, sometimes the outputs you're getting from AI is, you know, maybe 80% of the way there, but it certainly needs kind of that final polish to make sure it's ready for end users or for stakeholders or clients or whatever it may be. So I think, you know, I can see this role forming where it's a bit product management, it's a bit UX designer, meaning that you're still going to have design sensibility and understand best practices and look at the output from AI and say, that doesn't look right or that's not going to work. So I see that kind of being the evolution of our two roles, which unfortunately may, you know, prolong our turf wars, but I think, you know, could emerge where, like you said, there may be a lot more of those types of jobs out there where there's sort of the conductor of all the things.
I'm with you here. And I feel like, to me, the problem ultimately is the titles. Like we give ourselves titles and then we create groups and then we create an in-group and an out-group. And then the out-group is not like us and we hate them. And the in-group is like us and we like them. And this is a human thing we do all the time. But we gave ourselves these titles. But at the end of the day, what really matters is that there's a job to be done, right? Someone has got to do something. Someone's got to do this, that, whatever. And generally that group has been done by one title. And generally those other things have been done by another title. And as AI takes away that work, you don't need the two titles anymore. Now one person in theory could do it. You know, I think about things like UX designer versus interaction designer versus visual designer and all these things. Like those titles at the end of the day are really there for humans to sort of help quickly identify who does what. But there's no reason why one person can't do all three if they have the time. I mean, generally, it's just been a time constraint. I can't do everything. So I've got to hand it off to someone else. And I think personally, this is sort of something I've been kind of thinking about, especially after getting laid off not long ago, was like, I don't care what you call me. Call me whatever you want. Just pay me what I'm worth. You know, I don't care. Like, call me whatever you want. If I can do that stuff and do the discovery and that's what a product manager does, so what? I'm going to do it. But, you know, I think what's important from a UX design perspective is, and I think this is where traditionally, I think the two roles have had the most differentiator or the most differences has been that human-centered, that user-centered piece, right? And UX designers generally go to school or learn through that user-centered lens, whereas product managers, generally, they don't talk as much about user-centered and all that stuff. And I think if you were a UX designer and you have been given the job or the task to do the work of a product manager and you take it and look at that work through the lens of a user and you bring that empathy for users and that background as a UX designer, you know, I think that's the really important piece. And that's not to say a product manager can't learn that either, right? I mean, it's not to say UX designers are the only ones who can do it. But I think there is an advantage for UX designers to embrace this, to be honest, and do that. And if you think that, you know, it's just like everything else in capitalism and free markets, if you think you can do it better and you do it better, then you are more valuable and you will get the job and someone else who can't won't, in theory.
100%.
So I don't know. That's kind of my thought. And I think that's like, to me, the big thing is just the titles. Like I just, it's such a silly thing. And I think, again, this goes back to the whole product first, product led thing, which like product managers is the assumed owner of that. But, you know, the words we use matter and calling ourselves these various titles at the end of the day. And this is what drives me nuts. At the end of the day, we're all on the same team in theory, at least if we're working for the same company. Like we're there to build great software and we're there to deliver value to users or company or the business or whatever it is. Why are we fighting?
Man. Yep. Yep.
So I love that idea. No, I'm glad you're on the same page there. So that idea of like convergence, it's like, I think the thing that scares most people is they're worried about losing the job to the other side. But I think if you think of it less about losing your job to the other person or taking someone else's job, you just think about, I'm expanding my skill set so that I can do more and I am therefore more valuable to some team. And if it's not this team, hopefully I can find another team or something. And, you know, obviously getting laid off sucks and it's not ideal. But, you know, being able to leverage those skills, because there's value add. I think there's things to be said, like what product managers can bring to the table that UX designers probably can't do, you know? And I think if you can learn those things that the product manager is doing as a UX designer, if as a product manager, you learn those things that the UX designer is doing, I think that's at the end of the day, like all the, like the answer. I don't know. It's like easier said than done, obviously, but I don't know. I'm curious from your perspective, risks here. Like what are some risks for either side to kind of think about going forward as you think about this idea of like leveraging the skill sets or the whatever that other side does? What are some risks for both product managers and UX designers?
Yeah, I think, you know, you touched on it already. I think those who are UI designers that sort of live in Figma, that aren't interacting a lot with clients or stakeholders or, you know, end users, I think they're probably the most at risk. I think, you know, we're certainly encouraging some of our teams who live on that side here, or some of our folks that work for Slide UX, to start looking more at the UX strategy side of things, and you know, the research components, the workshopping, the, you know, user testing and so forth. So that to me is probably the most immediate risk. And I think there's a, you know, probably the 2 to 3 year window where those folks have to pivot or get off the ship. I think for, you know, the more well-rounded UX practitioners who do both strategy, research and design, I think they need to start looking more at kind of what product traditionally does. And that's what we're encouraging our strategists here to do. And why it's kind of neat for me to be, you know, the sole product practitioner in a UX firm, because I'm able to sort of work with and mentor some of these folks. And you know, that could be around like relationship building, you know, product, you're sort of in the middle of lots of different functions. And so having good relationships really helps getting things done. Communication skills, right? So you're presenting a lot in product, you're trying to influence others. You need to be able to speak different languages depending on which function you're talking to. So I think, you know, UXers should continue to look to make strides there. You know, using data and decision making. So being able to read a metrics dashboard or, you know, results from an A/B test, or even be able to roll up your sleeves and do a SQL query. I think that's going to be, you know, I think that's sort of part and parcel with product design, but certainly our team here as external UX resources don't get a chance to really get their hands dirty in the data. Curbing, you know, approaches to design. So I think a lot of UX designers are inherently perfectionists. And so what happens is they end up doing a lot of high fidelity or time intensive work where it's not needed. So being able to, you know, go back to that concept of, you know, move fast and break things, depending on, you know, the type of product or operation you're supporting, you know, things like roadmapping and prioritization, and just kind of even like, you know, the aspect of being able to work more closely with engineers. We don't get a ton of chance to do that closely. We're not sort of embedded in, you know, agile team. So, you know, understanding what the entire software development lifecycle looks like and being able to speak to engineers, relate to them and write user stories, things like that, I think are pretty important.
What about like from the product side, anything that a product manager could do to sort of shore up what they're doing that a UX designer team, that the UX design team is kind of doing today?
Man, I have learned so much being embedded with UX designers over the last 5 years, things that I didn't realize that I had gaps in. That, you know, it certainly make me a more well-rounded product person. So one is, you know, product, part of the reason product managers get burned out is you're like on this constant treadmill, you know, running 100 miles an hour, and you never have time to like really sit and do deep thinking, where part of the UX process is to make sure you carve out time to actually fully immerse yourself in something. So I think, you know, giving yourself more opportunity to do that deep thinking. Obviously, we talked a lot about user-centric focus. I certainly didn't have that early on in my product career. It was more metrics-based, and whatever the, you know, the executive I was reporting up to wanted is what we did. And that needs to change. And I think there's a lot of product folks that can change their mindsets there. Visual presentation. I am still not great at like looking at an interface and pinpointing where it can be improved or if it works or not. So I think, you know, I think that there's lots of improvement that, you know, we can learn a lot from y'all on the UX side in terms of just, you know, being visually conscious. Copywriting, you know, a lot of times that falls on UX teams, and I think we can do more there. You know, usability and accessibility best practices, and really, you know, something that struck for me at a conversation with an old colleague a few weeks ago. I've certainly been guilty of this, where you work on products and you're doing these kind of micro A/B tests and you're making decisions looking at like just a certain portion of your product versus it holistically. And I think UX does a great job of taking a step back and looking at the entire journey or the entire landscape of a product versus, you know, these micro sort of tests. And what happens a lot of times is you get a completely bastardized product because you're so focused on like one piece of it versus holistically. So I think we could learn a lot there.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think both UX and product teams could absolutely benefit from is actually service design. And I think this is something that kind of gets lost in the mix because there are not a lot of service designers. And historically speaking, the United States does a very poor job of service design. And if you think about Europe, you know, they have a lot of those corporations in Europe that will actually have service design orgs, and they'll have functions that are separate from design and everything else as service design. So I think like one thing that I would love to see more of, and I touched on this before, is this idea of service design and understanding the end-to-end thing, the journey from a customer's perspective beyond the product. You know, how do they find the product? What do they do when they have a problem? What do they do when they can't get something done, when there's an error, when something needs to happen and it's not within that product? It, you know, that might not apply to every single product. It might not apply to startups, but especially anything that's got like a physical interaction, like grocery stores or shopping or, you know, shit, even like in the medical industry. I mean, like there's so many opportunities there. And I think like beyond just hiring service designers, I don't just mean that. I mean, understanding that principle, the principle of customer experience, the principle of service design, and how that can improve our overall, you know, service essentially and the overall experience and not just the experience of a user, but the experience of an actual customer all throughout that process. Also, I mean, beyond just service design, I think research in general, generally speaking, research has been handled by, you know, very, very specific UX researchers with a very specific skill set. And I don't want to diminish their abilities because I think they've done an amazing job and they do amazing job and they've spent a lot of time and effort. But I think it's important for everybody to understand what they're doing and how they do it, not to democratize research necessarily. But, you know, if you're going to have a company who is not going to hire a researcher, and you know that, and you don't understand, like really understand how to do it right, because if you do it like half-ass, you're going to get junk data. You're going to get junk research, and that will then inform your product, and your product will be junk. So, you know, I know it's easier said than done for sure, but I think that's something really important is to be able to understand and do those things and understand your bias and where it plays into the decision-making and all that stuff that researchers are really good at. You know, not crafting a really crappy survey and leading all questions, getting answers that you expected and that you wanted, and then having that inform your roadmap, you're not going to end up with a good product at the end of the day. So anyway, I think that's really important. Again, I don't want to like say democratize research by any means, because I do think that's a specialized skill set. But I, you know, if your company isn't going to pay for the researchers, you're going to have to figure it out on your own. You're going to have to do as best job as you possibly can. So anyway, I think that's something that's really important from my perspective. And I think that's both design, UX designers, maybe they do a little bit of research, maybe they do some usability studies and things like that. But like when they get really into the weeds, I think most UX designers really don't understand research like they think they do. And the same, I think, goes for product managers as well. Like when they say they're doing discovery, I think they're just talking to a few people. I'm not saying every product manager is like that, but I think for the most part, my experience at least, product managers, when they're doing quote unquote discovery, they're basically just getting a list of requirements from some other person and calling that discovery. So anyway, I don't know. That's just my perspective.
I am guilty of that, and I totally agree. Yes.
We've had you for a little bit now. Before we get out of here, any resources for UX designers that are interested in learning more about product management? Any books or any websites or courses or anything you recommend that that you can give a UX designer to help them learn more about what it is you guys do and how to do it? Maybe not better than you, but to get up there on par with y'all.
Yeah, you know, this is probably where I'm not going to have a good response, because I'm not. It's been a while since I picked up product books, since I've sort of been living based off my own experience and in the UX world. So, you know, for me, it's, you know, you can only learn so much from books. I would say it's talking to product managers. If you have them within your organization or within your network, like go out and ask them what they do and what they struggle with and where they see things going. So I think communication and building relationships is probably as important, if not more important, than sort of reading blogs and podcasts and you know, the stuff that gets regurgitated in books.
That's a good answer. Yeah. Talk to your product managers. If you're not having regular one-on-ones with your product managers, I don't know what you're doing as UX designer. I'll be perfectly honest. You know, yes, if you're not talking to them on a regular basis, at least once a week, you're hopefully in meetings with them all the time. You should be going to lunch with them and getting coffee with them if you're in the same city. You know, if not, have virtual coffee chats and just hang out and get to know them. Please, for the love of God, if you're not doing that, I think personally, again, like I said, relationships are so important. And I think our biggest problem right now, more than anything, and I'm not talking about the thought leaders, I'm not talking about the people writing books and podcasts and all that crap. I'm talking about colleagues, people on the same team that work for the same company. I think the problem is we don't get to know each other well enough personally, and we end up creating like enemies when we should be friends, work friends at the very least, professional acquaintances, and we should not be fighting with our product managers. If you are headbutting with your product manager all the time, something is wrong there. I don't know. It's not your fault maybe, but it's something else is wrong. For the love of God, have a coffee with your product manager.
Love it. Yes, you're here.
All right, Tom, I got a few questions that I like to ask all my guests before we get out of here. Normally I ask design related stuff. This time I'm going to ask, normally I say non-design related stuff. This time I'm going to ask you non-product related stuff since you're not a designer.
Yeah.
But what is your favorite non-product book?
You know, this is a big cliche and it's an oldie but a goodie, but one of the books that kind of really informed and set my path from a, not only a professional standpoint, but from a personal standpoint is the old, you know, Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Yeah. You know, I've read a lot of self-help books over the years. That's the one that I will occasionally pick up and it still resonates. And there's still lots of great nuggets in there that seem very common sense, but people forget about it. And so, you know, when I talk to kind of young high school grads or college grads, this is the one thing that I recommend to them because I think it stands the test of time. Even just going back and looking at it, it's a reminder that I'm doing a lot of what I'm doing right with my relationships and my career.
I just cannot stress enough like how important those little soft skills are. They will get you so much farther than hard skills alone. You know, like you could be mediocre totally. In your craft, but if you can harness all those other things, you're going to get so much farther than just a jackass expert that no one wants to work with. You know,
yes.
So totally. Anyway, that's a great book. I love that book too. What is your favorite non-product podcast?
You know, the hardest, so I work from home. We are a 100% remote work from home company. And the hardest, you know, the biggest downside of it is I don't get that time in the car to listen to podcasts. Yeah. And I used to be a big commuter and a big podcast listener 5+ years ago. But when I do get, you know, road trips and when I am traveling some distance, I'm a big fan of Radiolab, which is, you know, New York NPR. Just such yes. a great variety of, you know, human yep. interest pieces and science and history and music. And I always, those stories always stick with me. And I end up talking about them to friends and family members. And it's just relaxing and puts me in a good mood. So I think, you know, there's a lot of insight and just personal growth that you can get out of those Radiolab episodes.
Absolutely. I don't know what the right word is for this, but like, you know, in movies, it's cinematography, like the way they shoot and the visuals, the way that they mix yes. together the yep. audio on radio. Like, I don't know how they do it, but like, there's gotta be a word for that. It's not cinematography, obviously, but whatever the audio version of cinematography is, they just do it so well. Like you can listen to an episode and immediately know, like that's Radiolab. Like I just know that totally. That's what that is, you know? So I don't know. It's whatever it is. I don't know. I love it. All right. What is your favorite meal?
So I'm a transplant. So I live in Austin, Texas. I moved here about 11 years ago. I'm a transplant from the Midwest and from Chicago. And so whenever I can get my hands on deep dish pizza, I will, yeah. it's euphoric for me. So we'll get a couple times a year, get them flown in. It's expensive, but it's worth it. And there's a few decent, places down here in Texas, but not quite the same as Chicago deep dish.
Yeah, dude. I'm lucky. I'm in Cincinnati. So we're not like too far from Chicago, but man, we've got some like great pizza like all around here, dude. Like Detroit style yes. pizza, Chicago pizza, like all within just like a few hours. Anyway, I don't know. There's actually like Ohio style pizza. It's like the sort of like thin crust, like square cut, but like pub style, yes. I guess is what they call it. I don't know. Anyway. Whatever it is, it's like, I never really had it before we moved up here. I guess I always thought it was like thin crust, but it's not thin crust. It's different. I don't know. Anyway, it's like buttery, flaky, crispy crust. But there's so many good pizza styles all around the Midwest that, you know, I don't know how many. I mean, everybody knows Chicago. I think most people know Detroit style yeah, pizza.
That's big down here. And that's the closest thing we have to deep dish. There's one of the best places in Chicago is called Pequod's, and it's got this kind of caramelized crust and it's really similar to Detroit style. So we got a place called Via 313 down here, and it definitely fits the bill.
Right on, man. Oh, I love good pizza. I could eat pizza every night, dude. That's the beautiful thing about pizza. There's so many different styles of pizza, too, that you could like have it all the time, and you never really get sick of it because it's always different. All right. What is your favorite vacation spot?
Man, I'm going to show my age here, and it's probably home. I got two young kids at home. We are super busy with soccer and extracurricular activities. So if you'd asked me 10 years ago, it'd probably be like Brazil or Germany, but it's, you know, there. And what I will say, moving to Texas, there's a lot of these great little quaint unknown towns that are just amazing, like Fredericksburg, Wimberley's by us, there's Green, Texas. And so what we've been doing is doing some kind of low key, you know, easy travel weekends to some of these locations. And I just love it.
Yeah. Austin's got a lot of really cool, like spots around too, like the Hill Country, I guess it is. And I got a friend down in Austin who actually has like an Airbnb on some lake
nice.
Close to Austin. So, you know, he gets to go down there when it's not rented out and stuff. But is Fredericksburg like that, like Bavarian German inspired like, little towns?
Yeah, it's about hour and a half to 2 hours in Hill Country west. And it's an old German settlement that they've sort of kept that vibe and got a lot of German restaurants and breweries and stuff. It's a neat place.
Yeah, that's really cool. I love that. Cool, man. All right. So the last question that I ask everybody is what their favorite design tool that's not Figma, but since you're not a designer, you wouldn't use Figma that much. I don't know what, I guess like Jira or Rally or something. What's your favorite tool that's not Rally or Jira?
I'm a Miro junkie. So if I have to do prototypes or wireframes or some ways to do it within Miro. And we do a lot of our work in Miro in terms of client presentations and, you know, conveying, you know, research and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm in Miro all day, every day. And it's easy enough to do decent, you know, conceptual design work. But I'm, you know, even though I'm a product person, I am in Figma on a daily basis as well, just to kind of, manipulate right. things here and there.
I'm a huge Miro fan as well. And shout out to Miro if you want to sponsor the show. But I like Miro a lot. And I actually like Miro better than FigJam. Yeah. I know everybody loves FigJam, probably because designers just love Figma by default. But Miro is so cool. I love that you can do presentations in Miro. Yeah. I think that's really cool. And all the plugins and everything. I mean, you know, Figma's got plugins and FigJam, obviously. But I don't know. Miro's plugins are really neat. A lot of the cool stuff you could do. I love Miro. That's what I did mostly in my last job as a service designer. I was probably in Miro more than anything else, to be honest. But all right, Tom, before we get out of here, that's it for us for today, by the way. Before we get out of here, let everybody know where they can find you. Give yourself a plug. You can, Slide UX and all that stuff. Where can they find you guys online?
So yeah, so we are Slide UX, which is slideux.com. We've been one of the sort of top ranked UX firms in the world for the last 8 to 9 years, at least according to Clutch. Look us up. My information's on there. Feel free to contact me directly at tom@slideux.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. My dad's name is also Tom Jurgen, but we don't have a too common of a name, so you could probably find me in a LinkedIn search.
Right on. And we'll link you up in the show notes too. So check out the show notes at beyonduxdesign.com. Tom, that's it. Thanks again for coming on, man. This was a fantastic conversation. And for everybody out there, get to know your product managers. They're not your enemy, okay? They're your friend, and you're all on the same team.
Same team. Love it. Great way to close it. Thanks, sir. Appreciate it, man.
Well, all right, y'all. That's it for Tom and me for today. I hope we helped to shed a little bit of light on the great PM versus UX debate. I really hope Tom's perspective as a product manager was helpful for you. But what's your relationship with your product team like? I'm curious. Do y'all get along well? Are you always stepping on each other's toes? Are you always fighting? Let me know what you think on LinkedIn or shoot me an email at hello@beyonduxdesign.com. I'd love to hear from you. If you like what you heard today, don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you feel like you're getting something out of the show, I would really appreciate you leaving a 5-star review. That'll help me out so much more than you can imagine. And if you know somebody who might find any of this stuff useful, then why don't you tell them about it? That'd be fantastic. One more shout out to Miguel for leaving some fantastic feedback for the Beyond UX Design book. Don't forget, if you pick up the book from beyonduxdesign.com/book and you leave some honest feedback, you'll get a chance to win a shout out on the show just like this one. So head on over to beyonduxdesign.com/book and use the promo code LISTENER to get 10% off your copy today. If you want to help keep the show independent and ad-free, check out all those Patreon sponsorship packages at beyonduxdesign.com/support. You can join Chris Siriquan, Stacey Radu, Megan Andrew, John Mark, Kevin, and many others and help keep the show independent and ad-free. And if you do, you'll get rough transcripts and exclusive access to the entire video library of episodes, including access to episodes before they're released. And you can get all that for as little as $3 a month. Do yourself a favor and head on over to beyonduxdesign.com/storytelling and use the promo code BeyondUX at checkout to get 10% off Jeff's storytelling course to learn some super valuable ways to influence your team and advance your UX career. Remember to sign up for the newsletter and check out all the past episodes along with all the show notes at beyonduxdesign.com. I hope you keep coming back for more great UX tips from Beyond UX Design. And until next time, remember, you're more than a designer because there's more to UX and design. I'll see you around. Take care, y'all. Awesome, dude. Cool.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity, Jeremy. Hope your whatever you kicked over there isn't broken.
I think it's all right.